The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the station, the university, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this show, visit KUCI.org. You're listening to 88.9 KUCI in Irvine. This is In the Garden with your host, Bill Brooks, University of California Master Gardener. We're talking today with Master Gardener Joanne Bird about school gardens. She is a bit of our expert here at the Master Gardeners. So welcome, Joanne. Please tell us a little bit about yourself as well as your interests in school gardens.
I've been a Master Gardener since 2008. And one of the first projects that I got involved in was I went through some training by a group out of UC Santa Cruz. Life Lab put together training, and it was really all centered around training you how to work with schools and children in the garden. It kind of interests me a whole lot, and I thought, you know, it'd be fun to give back. And I saw also with my grandkids, they just love working in the garden. And I had a grandparent that taught me gardening and got me hooked from many, many years ago. And I thought, well, this is one of the areas that I'd like to focus on as a master gardener. So that's what I do. I lead a group of volunteers that are trained to work with schools and with youth groups that have gardens like Boys and Girls Clubs or Scouts and stuff to let them, you know, how to work with children in a garden.
So I spent 40 years in the classroom. I'm a retired teacher, and our school didn't get a garden until 2014, which was 3 years before I retired, unfortunately. Could you talk a little bit about the school garden phenomenon? Is this something new?
It really isn't. Actually, going all the way back to when the First Lady of California was Maria Shriver, she was the whole push behind. There was some legislation passed, and there was a book created called Creating and Maintaining Your School Garden. I think over 100 schools, 200 schools in Orange County itself, all got grant money to help build or create school gardens. So it's been going on a long time. But the interesting thing about it is that it started out more of a total focus on academics, and it has somewhat changed over the years that now the focus isn't just on academics, but a little on nutrition and the obesity epidemic to get children to think of gardens in other ways. So they're still out there.
That's good to know. And across the United States, and you may not be able to answer this, but you could tell us a little bit about the trends perhaps. Approximately how many schools or what percentage of schools do you think have a garden?
Not enough. How's that?
That's
I don't know the exact numbers, but I can tell you that when I first started into the, you know, working with schools in the late 2000s, that there was no network of people within the state of California or even all of the United States to talk to each other about how to do it. And now there is a pretty strong network. There are conferences that I've been to. There was one in Pasadena a couple of years ago where we had teachers and master gardeners and other interested parties from all over the United States meet to talk about what they're doing with their school gardens. And there's a lot of resources available. So there's online resources, Facebook groups, networking sites that schools and people interested in school gardens can get together.
Oh, fantastic. So here's the big loaded question that I know our audience wants to know is, why have a school garden?
You know, it interestingly enough, there was a survey done of all of the schools in California to see if they had a school garden, and then what were the results, and so why should you have a school garden? And we actually have a hook on our website for the PowerPoint presentation with all the details. But what the main thing is, there's still academics being taught in school gardens, and that they find that kids that are involved in a school garden do better in school. They do have better relationships. They learn a lot of cooperation with each other and how to work with others. They learn a lot about better eating and nutrition because they get to eat what's in the garden. And so there's a lot more than just the academics, but the reason you have a school garden is it does teach children a lot, plus it gets them outside in a lot of cases.
Wow. And so do you know of any impacts of academic success at all? And I know this is This is a hard thing, but we always look at schools as wanting to be academically successful. Anything on academic success within a school garden?
Well, this survey or the study did give some statistics and numbers about how some of the successes have occurred. We actually work with a school garden and down in Aliso Viejo that put in a garden, measured some success, and got an award and went to the White House and met back in the day. It was with President Obama. They were given an award for how well they incorporated the school garden into their school. And so I think that the numbers are there and the study gives all the details, but off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you exactly what the impacts were. But it crosses a lot of subject areas. So, you know, a lot of people think, oh, it's math and science is what you're going to learn in a garden. But what we've actually found is that it's not just it's not just math and science, but social studies. So you'll learn about California missions and things that are in a garden in California, art. So a lot of times let the kids do their own artwork in the garden with, you know, signs on plants and stuff like that. And then keeping journals. We always ask the kids to keep a journal of everything that happens and tell stories about what they're doing in the garden. So it reaches beyond the normal math and science subjects, which are important, and they probably are the number one and two that they learn, but they do touch other areas. And when you get up in the age group in the garden, we actually have things for high school level. And I've worked with high schoolers in Orange County that as their high school senior project had to do something and it was related to gardening.
Well, that's fabulous, because one of the latest buzzwords right now in education is STEM,
yes,
which is science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, mm-hmm. as contrasted to STEAM, which is science, technology, engineering, art, and mathematics. And that's all the rage in education. And so you're telling me, if you could elaborate a little bit more on maybe the art and the writing, because you're also bringing writing and social studies in. So if you have anything to add to the curricular aspect, because this might be good for a parent.
There's a lot of information that will be on our, that you could look on the Master Gardener website under Youth Gardens, that will give you links that there is a whole slew of curriculum that has been developed by various groups, including the California Department of Education, but other groups of activities in the garden that are particularly related to not only the STEM stuff, but the STEAM stuff. And so there'll be things about things that you want to do, like write a story about something you have you're seeing in the garden. So you're, or you know, do paint a picture or draw something related to something in the garden. So it's filled with ideas for teachers or parents or volunteers that are running the school garden to do an activity with the children related to their age group. So you can do the curricular stuff. For example, we always do something about what the parts of a plant with the kindergartners and first graders, because that's what they're learning. But the third graders are learning about decomposers. So that's when we start talking about, you know, they really get into the roly-polies and the worms and the decomposers. And then fourth grade, you're learning about California missions. So we've had schools that plant a mission garden, and the kids are really researching what did they grow in their gardens, what did they eat back then. So it's they're learning the history. In addition, then they're talking about the actual plants in the garden too. Interestingly enough, we can go really far in the STEM stuff. We have curriculum that you give you a link to curriculum that for an AP physics student in high school can do projects and learn the AP physics and the calculus that's all involved in composting. Because it's integral calculus in it, and they're learning all of the information about, and it's like biochemistry, I mean, all sorts of things about the decomposers and microfiles and all that other stuff. And it was put together by Cornell University. So there's stuff for every age from pre-K to high school.
That sounds fabulous. The other question I was going to ask you was about school curriculum, and it sounds like the State of California website as well as...
Yeah, Department of Ed. I mean, and then there's all sorts of sites across the United States. Life Lab has one. Within California, there's a group called the California School Garden Network at csgn.org. You go to their website and it's filled with information and places to get grants to get your garden going, to curriculum, to training for teachers, everything that you need.
Well, that's fabulous. You intrigue me a little bit with a mission garden. Can you tell us what some of the plants might be found in a mission garden?
Well, think about what they grew in a mission. Olives, grapes, barley. They needed a lot of beans. They're the top ones, and then wheat. So they grew a lot of wheat and barley, grapes, olives. That was more in the Southern California. If you actually go down to the mission at San Juan Capistrano, they still have some of the olive trees that were there from when Father Ynipo Serra was there. So they still have some of the things still sitting around in the garden this time.
Wow, I know olive trees live a long time, and that's really cool to go down and touch something like that. Can you tell us a little bit about the trends and the types of school gardens? Are schools doing just vegetables? Are they focusing on water-wise plants, native plants, plants that are part of the curriculum, such as sixth graders planting a papyrus because they study ancient Egypt?
Well, just about all of the gardens grow vegetables. And that's been pretty clear, because the kids it's something that they can relate to more. But we're finding is that, you know, when we started having the drought, more and more native. So they'll have a section of the garden, or they'll put aside if they have multiple beds. They might do native plants in one. They might do a butterfly garden to learn about pollinators and bees and things like that. So tying that science into the class. The high schoolers, you know, if they're taking environmental sciences, they're going to grow something different. So when we do the training, we'll actually talk to what we call theme gardens. You know, for some of the kids, it's a lot of vegetables. You may want to plant a pizza garden. So what are all the things that you go to make, you know, that you would put vegetables you put on a pizza, or a salsa garden, or a lettuce garden, you know, things like that. So we're looking for themes, and that helps get the kids interested in it. So it's across the board, but I would say 90% of them start with vegetables.
And then maybe expand, and I guess a pizza garden would be some basil, oregano, and tomatoes.
And peppers,
right.
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds tasty. What fun. And so what about a school orchard? Are there schools that specialize or grow fruit trees? And I believe the school could plant a fruit tree that would relate to just about any grade level's curriculum.
Yeah, so it depends on the school district. There are school districts in Orange County that they're not allowed to grow fruit trees because they're concerned about pest control. You know, I have a squirrel that loves to visit one of my fruit trees. Anyway, so it depends on it. So every school is different. You have to check with the school district. But a lot of schools do have fruit trees. But I will warn you, schools aren't year-round. And there are certain fruit trees that need a lot of care in the summer when schools are closed and they're not getting watered. So you don't see as many orchards with stone fruit and apples and things like that as you would citrus that is in bloom in the school year, so that you can grow citrus here. But peaches and stuff, what a lot of schools have to do and what we recommend is to do them in big pots. And we have some schools in Orange County that grow them in a pot, and at the end of the school year when school gets out, the pot gets moved and some parent takes it home for the summer and takes care of it and then brings it back in September. So yes, you can grow fruit.
Oh, that's a good idea.
But you have to think about, you know, is somebody going to be there in the summer, and is it going to get watered, because it will die if you don't have it taken care of.
Yeah, that would be for sure. So it sounds like most schools like to grow a lot of vegetables. And so do you recommend plants that are started from seeds, or purchasing already growing ones from a garden center? And tell us a little bit about the pros and cons of starting by seeds or starting with a young plant.
Okay, so because the school year is mostly during the cool season, we do provide schools and teachers with a list of the best cool season crops. And like carrots and radishes, which are on that list, which are things that grow year round here in Southern California, we'll tell them by plant which ones to grow from seed versus a transplant. So carrots and radishes, actually, you should start them from seed. And, you know, we'll teach them about it. But things like broccoli, it grows better if you don't start it from seed. But we do have schools that let the kids start it from seed, and that's part of the learning process, to learn how a seed grows, like a pea or a bean or, like I said, broccoli, to see it actually open up and learn the parts and watch it grow. So they'll maybe do that in the classroom and then put it out in the garden when it's grown. So there are things that it's really by vegetable, which ones you do seeds and which ones you don't. And it's really, a lot of it depends on how much room. You know, if you have a room, you could actually put a zucchini in our gardens in Southern California, like at the end of February, beginning of March, and get your first zucchini before school went out. But, you know, after that and they turn off the water, you know, it's not going to go any further. So it's mostly that what we see in California are the things that grow with, you know, in the cool season. Strawberries you can get in. Kids love to grow strawberries. And those you would also, you can start from bare root or you buy the plants. And so that's really, it's how much money do you have and how much room do you have?
Room and money.
Yeah.
Because that leads us into planning a school garden. I'd like to talk a little bit about the planning process and the installation of one. In planning for a garden at my particular school, what do you think would be the ideal amount of space? Do you have any idea what that would be, besides taking over the whole playground?
You know, it really depends on how big you want to start. If there's a bunch of teachers, like five or six teachers that all want to do it, and they have a strong group of volunteer parents that want to work with them, I would have each teacher have their own bed. If there's really just one person, one teacher or one group within the school, start small, do one bed at a time and build a raised bed, which is what we usually recommend. We don't like, a lot of the teachers, we don't have them put it on hard, you know, on a hard concrete surface or something like that. They have to find a green spot that has water. So it's really, the planning is the most important decision is where are you putting it, not how many. Is, does it have water? Does it get 8 hours of sun? And is it safe and secure for the children? And, you know, away from the public and things like that is more important. Does it have, you know, a good, it's not going to get flooded and stuff like that. So that's really the things that are more important than how many beds. It, you know, the beds, if you have a success with one bed, then it's easier to grow more, and it's easier to keep up with it. So probably start small.
And I would even imagine involving kids in studying where sunlight is coming from on the ground and in the planting process would be something that would be awesome. And with that, I know California has a lot of clay soil. Some of our schools in the middle of the county have pretty good soil, but I'd imagine most schools need to do a raised bed, especially if they're going to grow vegetables. So tell us about a bed's ideal height and the material that you think works best at a school for building the beds out of, and is there a material that works particularly well in the bed design?
I'm going to use my favorite word. It depends. Everything is depends. We mostly recommend that schools build raised beds and do it over soil, you know, in the ground. And the height of the bed and the size of the bed is almost entirely dependent on the age of the kids that are going to be working in the garden. Because you don't want to have kids walking in the bed. So we never build the beds big enough for kids to walk in. And so if you're working with kindergartners and first graders, you're probably going to have a bed that's only 2 or 3 feet deep, so that they can walk around all the way and their arms are long enough that they could reach into the center. So you could have it 2 or 3 feet deep and, you know, like 8 feet long. And all of the kids that age, you might only want to have it 6 inches tall, 4 inches tall. You could use old bricks, you could use cinder blocks, whatever, you know, put a cinder block on the ground and put it in a rectangle and fill it with soil and you got a bed.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're doing it with fourth and fifth graders, you may want to have it a foot tall and you may have it four feet deep because their arms are longer and they don't need to walk down. So it really is, it's more about accessibility for the children than so that it's going to change for as they get older. Now, we also, it'd be great if everybody could afford cedar, untreated. You know, you don't want wood that has a lot of treatment on it. We don't want it leaching into the soil because it's things you're going to eat. So cedar or those, you know, those plastic wood things like the Trex or whatever, they would be great too if you could find an Eagle Boy Scout that could build them for you and you had a lot of money. But some of the things that we try to show and provide information is how to do it with almost no money, since nobody has any money to do things like that. So an idea is like is cinder blocks. Cinder blocks are pretty cheap. You can just lay them. They're easy to put down on the ground. If you want them one high, then for younger kids, put two on top of each other. The cool thing about cinder blocks is you do them on the side so the holes are out and you can fill the holes with soil and grow things around the edges and then something on the inside. So really, when we talk about the beds, it's what materials do you have? Do you have an Eagle Scout? Do you have a parent in the school? You know, what we try to get folks to do when you're creating it and the planning is try to get something out in the newsletter to all the families. So if anybody has supplies or materials that they want to donate, have a community day or a parent day and bring everybody together and, you know, see what you have or have people tell, you know, send into the school what kind of materials they have and then try to find people that know how to build them. You'd be surprised how many parents know somebody or is, you know, landscaping or is good with a saw or some kind of a mechanical device that could help build your beds for you.
That sounds great. And I like the idea of a Eagle Scout project of reaching out to there. That's something I hadn't thought about. But it sounds to me like you said the important thing is to find an area in the school that's not on a playground. So you would not want to build a bed atop an asphalt playground.
Correct.
You'd want to find a grassy area that you could convert or a planter area that
without
you can convert.
Around.
Yeah, to give
without
that shade.
Big tree.
So about how many beds should a school make? Would it be best for a bed per grade level or per classroom? Or how do you go about doing that and think that through?
It really depends on the teacher involvement, how much the principal is behind it. We have a school in Tustin that every classroom has a bed, and they have a pretty big space, and the principal's behind it, and kids are out in the garden every day. And we have other schools that'll have a single bed for grade level, or only three or four beds for the whole school, and everybody take turn. I think part of the difference is when you're planning the garden is to think not only where it is, but what type of garden you want to do. And so we have schools like the school in Tustin that it's part of the everyday academic curriculum. And so kids are there during the school day. But we also have schools, we have one in Laguna Beach, that it's an after school activity. So it's not part of the everyday, but it's a club that the kids do after school. We have some that are before school or just during lunchtime. And so kids can sign up for it, and it's not related specifically to a teaching environment, but it's a club to learn about it, and they get input from the teachers to feed it, you know, to design activities for the kids to do while they're in the garden. So that'll change, you know, some of the things of how many you'll have, depending on what type of garden you have to begin with.
So it sounds to me like as we're getting into this planning process of a school garden that take your time to plan it. Make sure that you're doing it right.
Yep.
With that said, what's the ideal medium for putting between the beds for students and teachers to walk on?
No mulch, no tripping. You know, a lot of people will just put dirt or DG, you know, like or tiny, tiny stones. If you can have concrete, it's probably not the best, but you want to have it. I mean, if you have kids that have disabilities or wheelchairs, you have to have it accessible to some degree. But I think it's more like don't put gigantic stones that are hard to walk in or big pieces of mulch that are hard to walk on. You definitely want to have something that's hard and flat. I wouldn't put grass because grass will grow into the garden. That gives you weeds. So it just, and usually plan 3 feet between each bed so that there's plenty of room for kids on each side and for wheelbarrows or other things to work between the beds.
So it's 3 feet, and you basically are thinking about how to keep the mud off of students' feet when they're working in the garden.
Yes.
And then have a material down that is not tripping, and you said no mulch, and why is that?
Not the big clunky mulches, because it's an uneven surface, and it would be really hard for kids that have, are they're in a wheelchair or have a disability, or even adults working, it's hard to walk on some of that. A lot of times they'll wear flip-flops or shoes, and you know they'll be running into those materials, so it's probably better not to have heavy mulches around it.
Perfect. So we just want to make sure, again, we keep the mud down.
Yeah.
Here in California, we've got to irrigate. Mm-hmm. And that sounds to me also like that might be the success of keeping a school garden going over the summer months when no one is there. So tell me about drip versus sprinkler irrigation or watering by hand, a little bit about the options there.
So we always tell that, like, about the location of the garden. Is it near irrigation? Well, we'll have the kids water it. Yeah, who's going to water it over spring break or over the summer or when you have a week off and it's dry and it's hot in May or, you know, whatever. So we try not to have them be use only by hand watering to be the source of irrigation. Once you decide that you're going to have it irrigated by a mechanical means, drip is better. But sprinklers work fine. A lot of what we teach is a lot of times they'll have the the sprinklers that you know a lot of people have in their lawns, and we'll modify them to be drip, and we'll have them work in the beds. So it doesn't. The more important thing is to have it irrigated versus by hand, and then we'll teach them how to irrigate it the best way.
In planning, you've got to find a sunny area that's not shaded by a tree or building. You want it over dirt. And you need to have a water source to be successful, because without the water source, it's not going to work. And tell us about fencing. Do school gardens need fences to keep the rabbits and other critters out?
Nothing keeps rabbits out. Are you kidding me? So, you know, one of the things that we also look is the security. So usually you want to have some kind of, fencing around where the garden is. Within the school, it could be totally open, but a lot of schools do have fencing, and so rabbits and gophers and things like that. So we teach how to protect from gophers with wire cloth underneath the bed. You put that down, and with fencing, a lot of times they'll put up chicken wire or other thing, but you have to go down deep in the ground for the rabbit not to go under or for them to bounce over. So they do that. Working with critters is one of the things we have to deal with. And some ways it's like, plan enough that we're going to share with them because we know they're going to be around. But there are some things that we'll show them with that you can put things over the plants. So instead of building a permanent fence, there are some things that netting and stuff like that, you could protect the plants when they're young. Because most plants, the rabbits like them when they're young and tender, but once you let them get a little bigger, they stop eating them. And so it's really just a timing thing on a lot of things with rabbits.
Yeah, so another thing that sounds to me like school should study is if you have rabbits and squirrels and gophers on your playground and school property, you need to keep that into consideration and how you're going to work with that. And of course, you don't want to put poison out on a school ground.
Correct.
It probably wouldn't go over well with killing any of these critters either.
No. No, you don't want to do that. So yeah, part of some of the training or the things that will help the volunteers, the teachers that work is how to take care of to fight against those pests. What most people don't know is that one of the most effective ways to kill pests in a garden, besides the gophers and stuff, is a hose. Having a, so when you have your sprinkler, also have a hose there, because just spraying the bugs off the plants kills a lot of them.
Yeah, and that keeps it organic, which we have to do too.
Yeah.
So this is our mid-show point. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the station, the university, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this show, visit KUCI.org. You're listening to 88.9 KUCI in Irvine. This is In the Garden, and we're talking about school gardens with our guest, Joanne Bird. And we're ready to move on. We're talking in the middle about expanding school gardens. So let's talk a little bit about once the garden is established and the newness wears off, how do you keep the momentum going? A garden club, teacher parent, community leader, what works best?
All of the above.
Okay.
Yeah. So what happens with a lot of schools is that I've worked with that there'll be a parent that has a new child in kindergarten at a school. And they're starting elementary school. The parent was working with the teacher. They get all excited. They get the school garden going. And the teachers may not be involved as much, or they, you know, it's a garden club. And they get it going. And then the kid goes through. And all of a sudden, you know, the parent's working. They get a couple others. And then the kid's in sixth grade. And then they move on to another school. And without that parent, it dies. And so some of the things that will help a school with is how to revive a garden and teach them how to every year work with the volunteers or work with the teachers. So we offer training classes for teachers, and we actually have a demo garden at our research station at South Coast Research and Extension Center, so that teachers can come out, children can come out, school groups can come out and actually see the different things about how to keep things exciting in the garden. And we'll show how to build a garden, how to create it. And like I said, sometimes the teacher, it's part of the academic, and so the teachers are involved and they want to have it going. Mm-hmm. But it really does help to get a garden club going and get the PTA involved and the administration of the school to get everybody excited about why there is a garden there and what they can do to keep it going. So the more volunteers, then you keep getting new volunteers and new teachers every year that are doing it and being involved in it. We have a lot of schools that use their garden and they harvest the food that they grow, and one day a week they sell the produce. It's actually, you know, they're allowed to do it. There's actually a law passed by the state legislature that the school garden could actually sell their produce to the cafeteria. And the cafeteria can buy it, and the money can go to the kids. So the kids learn how to sell, how to count money, how to take care of it all. But the money goes back into the garden, but they sell it to the parents. So you'll have a little sprig of parsley or, you know, two radishes, and, you know, they're 50 cents or a dollar. But we've had a lot of schools raise a lot of money to keep the garden going. And that makes kids excited about it. And if it's self-funding with what is the food that comes out of it, it helps keep it going. Because people just think it's going to be a big money sink that I have to buy new stuff every year. I have to buy fertilizer. I have to buy all these materials. Well, if it keeps going, then they have enough money to keep it going, and the kids get excited about it.
That's a great idea, your own school's farmer's market. That's
exactly.
Fabulous.
One school does it every Thursday, and it's open at the time that the parents pick up the kids at the end of the day.
What?
So they walk up to the school, and there's just a table filled with things that are 50 cents to a dollar or $2, and they made over $7,000 last year that paid for the school garden.
How big of a space are they using? Do you know roughly?
It's a pretty big one. They have a bed for every classroom. So it's pretty big. And the kids eat the food, and the parents are heavily involved in it. So it's a good one, but it is completely self-funded.
You get some friendly class-to-class competition on the farmer's market, I'm sure, is
exactly.
What they're specializing
exactly.
in. So the other big question is, of course, most schools have long breaks, especially the summertime. So what do most schools do with their gardens over the summer?
Well, and during the, some of them go dormant. I mean, so that's why they don't have fruit trees or they don't have certain things growing, and they'll just shut it down because they turn the sprinklers off. A lot of schools, the sprinklers aren't working during the summer, so it's not, there's nothing they can do about it. So they grow cool season crops, and when they're leaving at the end of the year, they pick the final stuff, put straw or mulch over it for the summer, and just let it sit. And then, you know, the parents reopen it, you know, the, probably 2 or 3 weeks before school starts, somebody goes out there, they turn the sprinklers on and get it going again. We do have some schools, though, that will allow parents to go in and work on the garden if they have fruit trees. There's a school that what they do is the sixth graders at the end of the school year plants pumpkins in a big part of the garden that usually has lots of different vegetables, and they fill the garden, or they almost fill it with pumpkins. And they have 2 or 3 parents from the sixth grade class that agree to take care of it during the summer, and they grow pumpkins. And the kids move on to the next grade, and the new sixth grade class comes in September, and they start harvesting the pumpkins. They actually sell them to all the parents, and then that's a way of they as a giveaway to the school as their graduation. So there are some that run, you know, do something over the summer, and like I said too, if they have fruit trees, some of them, you know, farm them out to parents to take care of them, or have parents that come in and take care of them over the summer. So you have to do something special over the summer here, unless you're, you know, a year-round school.
Yeah, well, that's I guess that's intriguing, and I guess to raise money, and I guess if you're a principal and you really want to raise a lot of money, take your playground out and fill it with avocado trees, and you could you could make your budget up there.
Yeah, too much water.
Yeah.
Pumpkins.
Yeah. So composting and vermiculture, do schools add this component to their garden, and is this difficult to do?
A lot of schools do have compost facilities because what an interesting, if they have a garden in the high school, it's even more because they're learning a lot of environmental stuff and not wasting. But when kids learn about decomposers and things like that in science, there's also things that, because when you learn about composting, you're learning about how different things and how hot a compost pile can get. So there's doing a lot of math. They keep track of how geeky this can be is they measure the temperature and they see the high temperature, the low, the medium, the average temperature, you know, all sorts of things that you can relate to a math class or a science class. So yes, composting is done in a lot of schools. Some of the vermiculture will be done inside the classrooms because you can keep worm bins in a classroom. It's much easier and you can take care of them. They're totally safe. They're not going to go crawling all around. So you do see composting. It's where they have a lot more room. And most of them want to have a place that they don't have, that they know what to do with the waste from the garden. Mm. And so they learn what can go in a compost bin, so they have a place that, you know, they can then put back fresh nutrients back into the soil. So yeah, there's composting.
Yeah, the vermiculture would be a good idea because I know you can't have worms get too hot, so keeping it in the classroom might be very workable.
And somebody could take it home over the summer. You can't take a compost bin home.
That's
true. But you can take the worms home.
Yeah, what a fun, I'm sure that would be fun for a student to get to take the class's worms home and play with them and all that stuff. So let's talk about getting started. We've talked about the planning process, and so now you're ready to get started. And if I'm a teacher, an administrator, a parent, or a grandparent, how do I get a garden started at my school? Are there some good steps to start with?
Well, a little self-serving, but what I would recommend is to go to another school that has one and ask them what worked for them and what didn't. We have facilities here at the research station that we host schools, administration. We just had a school from Mission Viejo and about 8 teachers come up and spend a couple hours in our youth demo garden. And we'll take them through all the things we talked about, what to plant, where to pick the site, how to work the irrigation, what materials to use, what type of plants to. So a lot of that, you do your homework ahead of time, go to a site, see what it has. On our website, the Master Gardener website, there's a place at the bottom of the page that has it says if you want to consult. And so here's an interesting thing. Master gardeners don't go to people's homes to help them if they have a gardening question. You can send a question in the website and we'll answer it. Master Gardeners will do on-site visits to schools.
Ooh, good to know.
It's the one thing. Every Master Gardener gets fingerprinted, so we have background checks that we're safe. And a school's a safe environment, so we do on-site consults. So I just did one the other day. A school in Mission Viejo wanted somebody to come out and help them. They have a garden. They had a lot of questions. Just set up the appointment, met the principal. He took me out. There were four or five teachers there. And they, you know, for an hour, they just asked me questions. I answered stuff. It's like, don't plant this here. You know, this tree doesn't look so good. You should, you know, do that, this and that. So we'll actually come out and help them plan. We've gone to schools that didn't have a garden at all. A school in Costa Mesa wanted to. And there were two of us that went out, and they were thinking of putting it on the asphalt. We talked them out of it, put them someplace else. And now they have a huge flourishing program. So we'll help them pick the site and then help them think about all the things they need to plan in terms of what type of program, what kind of beds, how many beds to start, what to plant in it, and all of that stuff. So if any school wants to start a thing, what I would do is ask for a consult. They're free. We come out, and a master gardener that knows how to work with kids in a garden and the things you want to think about, kids versus adults, because the tools you work with, the sizes of the beds are all different than you'd have with adults working in a garden, is that we'll come out and spend some time with you. A lot of the master gardeners will help the school for the first year, answer questions, email back and forth, and then they'll go on and you know, they can take it on their own from then on.
Wow. That's a resource that people have to realize.
Yes.
The money, I know there's some upfront costs, especially if you're a school without a garden. So are there grants available? Do you have any ideas on funding?
Oh, there's thousands. There's thousands of grants. Whole Foods has them. Kids Gardening has them. There's a lot of Lowe's and Home Depot. The box stores have money or discounts that they could do it. On our website and that CSGN website, there's a lot of places that you can find that have different grants. There's a group, California, for Agriculture in the Classroom. They have you can go to their websites and it'll show you all the available grants and the deadlines and what information you have to fill in. I mean, they're constantly going on. They're not big, you know, $250, $500. And a lot of times that's just enough to get started in the garden. And there's all sorts of ways, you know, you can go from there. But yeah, there's hundreds of them.
So you can search them out. I would imagine, can you get more than one grant, or have you heard of a school?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, yeah, and usually, like Whole Foods, they call it Whole Kids, they might give $1,100 grants, you know, to schools. So, you know, schools are getting, you know, money from all different locations. There are some bigger ones that you can go for, like $20,000, and that pays for a part-time teacher or somebody one day a week to come in the garden. But the little ones to get started are easier to win or to get. And, it's all online.
So you wouldn't need to be too much of an expert, although a lot of school districts I know have grant writer and grant writer consultants that you could take advantage of. So let's spend a little bit of time talking about the South Coast Research and Extension Center's Youth Garden. Mm-hmm. Now, if you haven't been here, the South Coast Research and Extension Center is located at 7601 Irvine Boulevard in Irvine. And it has this youth garden that's awesome. And please share some information about the youth garden, how to bring a group out, when it's open to the public. And anything you can tell us about that would be a great thing for us to know and talk about.
So normally the research station, the South Coast Research, is not open to the public at any time, at least not the youth garden. You have to make an appointment. There's a lot of scientists that work here that are doing agricultural research, and so they don't want to have people just mow around. Now, a couple times a year, they do open it to the public, and it's advertised so that you can come in and you can walk through, and we staff the garden with the youth garden area with people that are knowledgeable in it. But the other thing that we do in addition to the consults is that if a school wants to bring some teachers out, or if a school wants to bring a bunch of their children out for a site visit, or a Girl Scout troop wants to come out and help their Girl Scouts earn a badge, or a Boy Scout troop wants to earn a badge. We've had Boys and Girls Clubs. So any kind of group that wants to take kids or adults to learn about gardening with children, there is a form, or there's a number they can call to schedule an appointment. It's either on the South Coast site, and I think we have it on our site too, that they can schedule an appointment to bring a group out and spend an hour or two in the youth garden. And there, when you go into the garden, it'll give you samples of different types of beds. So some made with brick, some made with the plasticized Trex type wood, some made of regular wood. You'll see regular fruit trees, you'll see espaliered fruit trees. So we have a mixture of all different gardening techniques. We have lots of things in potted plants, containers, so that they can see all the different things and ideas for how to, of things that you can garden with kids. We have our containers is a container view box. So one side of the box is clear plastic, and it has a sliding cover over it so that you could grow, say, carrots in there, and you plant the seeds right near the side, and then the kids could actually look and see the carrots growing underground.
Fascinating.
So that's some of the things that, so that they can make an appointment to come out and visit here, and we'll have staff it with one of our volunteers that knows all about to help you do the planning. Or if you're stuck and you want to revive the garden, to revive your garden, come out and spend the day, or not the day, but a couple hours with us, and we'll do the brain dump of all the ideas that we have of working with kids in gardens.
So you could do it either with a group of school kids, or you could bring out and do like a teacher in service or workshop here.
Yes, we actually had a school district up in Huntington Beach that brought 12 of their pre-K teachers here. And it was on an in-service day that they came for 4 hours, and they came, you know, at the afternoon of their in-service with their principal, of one of the principals of the school district, and we just spent the whole time on what to do with the pre-K kids, yeah. So all the things and what kind of gardens, what they should plant, ideas, activities to do with them. And, you know, what kind of materials, how to build the bed specifically for that 8th grade level. So, yeah, any type of in-service could be had. We could do it on a Saturday. You know, so we have lots of options to meet your schedule, even if it was like 2 hours after school one day.
So it can be done, and this is an awesome resource, and probably, in my opinion, where someone would start.
Yes.
And I know next door to the youth garden is also composting. So
yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about the composting training and things that go on in there?
I don't know all the details of it, but they do have, we collect a lot of the waste from the research station here, and we bring all the compost, and we actually have compost going in different stages of being cooked and ready to go. And so we'll have, when the research station is open for the public, will have classes here, and then they do offer other types of classes that you can sign up for and learn about composting, and, you know, what kind of bins were. They have lots of different samples of bins. They do have a worm bin, so a little vermicultures here, so that next to that, you know, you can learn a little bit about composting while you're in the youth garden too, or vice versa.
Yeah, because I know a big thing within Orange County is to keep our landfills open and not putting green waste in there.
Right.
And I know schools have taken an active role
right. In
reducing their green waste by composting, which
right.
is a great way to learn that. And so students could actually see that temperature changes in the compost piles
yep.
here, or teachers,
yep.
because it's not that hard to do if you're willing to do it.
Yep.
So again, that's the South Coast Research and Extension Center at 7601 Irvine Boulevard in Irvine. And that's at the UCANR website.
Yes.
Where you can find information. You can call or you can email and someone will get back to you. So homeschools, do you have any homeschoolers you work with?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, that's another group of, you know, if you're, there are homeschoolers usually are connected with other homeschoolers mm-hmm. and they're always looking for activities. So this is one of the things that will bring a whole group of homeschoolers with their parents, and they'll come and spend some time in the garden, and the kids will do some lessons with them. So we'll help them out, and we'll work, you know, with the ages and stuff of that ahead of time. But yeah, the homeschoolers is another group that could come out and spend, you know, a couple hours in the garden to learn a little bit about it, or to think about how they would put a garden in maybe their house that the parent then teaches the kids, you know, some of the academics, but it's in their own home garden.
And I guess if there were a homeschooling parent that had the space at their own house, they could set up a school garden in a sense for their homeschool
yep.
community. Do you know of anybody that's had success with that?
No, I don't.
But that's an idea. And so Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts certainly too, because there's a yeah. lot of community service that can go with that. And even if a Boy Scout troop or a Girl Scout troop isn't going to grow a garden, they might want to experiment with composting.
Yep.
And
yep.
this would be the place to
right.
learn about it.
Yep.
So do you have any additional tips or words of wisdom on school gardening that you could share with us before we're done today?
I would think that if you were going to start a garden with a school and working, think about what would make, you know, keep kids engaged. So don't make a lot of lecture and talking, but let them do things. And the other thing that I have a lot of schools that they grow, say, peas, and they're so excited, they just look at the peas. I'm like, eat them. Harvest your food. You know, you could start picking lettuce when it's, you know, it's got 10 leaves on it. You don't have to wait till it's a full head of lettuce. Eat the food every day. When I was working with a school down in South County, a bunch of kindergartners, the first thing that they would ask every day I showed up, are we eating today? Because they got so used to I was going there once a week, every week they would eat something out of the garden. And there was a child there, a little boy, that the volunteer said he never eats green things, his mother said. It's like, okay. And I have a deal with the kids. There's a thing called a no thank you bite. And so you're allowed, I give you a sugar snap pea, you take a bite, and if you don't like it, you can spit it right out on the ground. That's a no thank you bite. Like, I don't like this, no thank you. And it's like, it'll go into compost, it's okay. And this little boy, a little peer pressure, he decided he would try this sugar snap pea. He took a bite and his eyes lit up and he goes, it tastes like candy. Can I have another one? And the parent almost fell on the ground, like couldn't believe that this child was eating green vegetables. But I think that the wisdom is don't look at the food. Let the kids eat it as much as they can, because what we're seeing is that more and more, a lot of the funding, and I should jump back to that, a lot of the funding's coming from nutrition organizations. The American Heart Association was giving money. I got, you know, the Orange County Department of Education is trying to get kids to eat better, and what better way to teach them about nutritional things and good stuff is stuff they grew themselves, because if they grow it, they'll eat it.
Yeah, that sounds good. And it sounds like you're just eating things raw as you pick it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So you're getting the exact flavor of the plant. And a lot of us forget that raw food is not only good for you, but it tastes very good.
Exactly.
This has been a wonderful opportunity, and I hope that this motivates a lot of our listeners to get into school gardens, to see what can be done. And if you don't have a school that's interested, a co-op, a club, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, there are so many opportunities here. So the opinions that are expressed on this show today are not necessarily those of the station, the university, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on the show, visit kuci.org. You're listening to 88.9 KUCI in Irvine. This is In the Garden, and we've been talking about school gardens with our guest, Joanne Bird. Thank you, Joanne, for joining us today and sharing all of your knowledge. Now get your phones or your pencils or calendars or tablets ready, because I'm going to be sharing with you some very important upcoming events, and we can talk more about how you can get into gardening with our events that come up. And we usually have three or four major ones every month.